Hey, and welcome back to an exciting episode of Extra Features. Today, for the first time ever on the show, we have a film that hasn't been released yet. So I might be the first person ever to interview him, but I probably not about the film. His film, oh God, I forgot the name of it. Alpha Test is out in 2 weeks. So everybody gets that. I think it's on VOD, but he'll tell us at the end. Aaron Murtis is in the house, rhymes with Curtis. So I think I got it right. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, sir. Yeah, you got the name right.
Oh, wow. Don't tell anybody. I screwed up like the last five, so I'm probably in trouble. So I want to start, before we get into the film, what is Exit 10 Films?
Exit 10 Films is, it's just the banner I make these movies under, you know. It's, you know, the tax system is so funky and getting movies made financially is so funky. They're like, yeah, you have to be a corporation. I'm like, fine, I'll make my own little corporation. And so it's just the name we make these movies under.
So there's no, like, secret meaning to that, I guess, is what I was thinking of.
No, you know, it's funny because when I started out with it, I didn't know if I was going to be able to sustain as a filmmaker. So I thought, okay, I need to make a business name that could work for movies, but could also work for corporate videos, but could also work for wedding videos, because that's what I was doing at the time to sustain. And it was all under that umbrella. So I wrote a list of, like, nice, kind of clean, acceptable production company names. I didn't even live off Exit 10. I lived off Exit 18.
Well, that's what I was thinking. Maybe he is off Exit 10.
Yeah, just to pull that in air.
A lot of filmmakers put those little catches in, but I do have a couple more I want to look at later, but we'll get there. Let's discuss your locations right off the top.
Yes.
How many houses do you use? Two or three?
For just all my movies in general?
No, this movie.
For this movie, I used, two. I think I used two.
Okay, because you have the house at the beginning of the film.
Yeah, and then I have the house in the middle of the film.
Right, and I wasn't sure if we had a third house when you come out of the film at the end, if that was the same house.
Yeah, that was the same one.
Okay, because you don't really show us the outside of it. We see the front.
Yeah.
And then you have a guy that opens a parcel at one point, and I thought it was a different house. That's the same house from the beginning.
The guy who's opening the robot.
Okay, I can say robot. Okay, fine. Yes, the guy that's opening the robot.
Yeah, the guy that's opening the robot. That's a different house. So it's funny, we didn't show the front of that house because the weather was so bad throughout the shoot. And I kept missing my chances to get establishing shots. It was less so the weather, more so the daylight. We kept running out of daylight. I kept forgetting to get establishing shots. So I got like two establishing shots at the end. And I thought, okay, this will work. And then again in the edit bay, I'm like, crap, only one of these works. So yeah, you only see the front of that house once. But the other house, oh, there's the house at the beginning.
Yes.
Ah, there's also the house in the middle when, I don't want to spoil it because that's like the mid-movie twist, but there's a house in the middle. That's the same house as the house in the beginning.
That's what I thought.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I do pay attention to these things. I know I put you on the spot, but I do ask.
More attention than I do.
Okay. And you have a liquor store, right?
Yes, I got the liquor store.
And you have a farm.
Yeah. The farm was actually on the same land as the main house.
See, I didn't think it was. I know in the movie you establish that, like you kind of make me convince it. But yeah. I'm like, there's no way these people have this beautiful house and a farm. It just didn't work for me.
It's crazy. You see that a lot. We shot the movie in Tennessee, which is where I'm from, and you see that a lot where people got these real nice houses and then they have farms. The big pond that they hang out at is also the same land.
Okay, I can believe that one.
Yeah.
Okay, I thought, okay, so how did you get the houses? Let's start there. That's where I always like to start locations.
My producer, Maddie Johnson, is a friend of somebody, and she was like, yeah, my childhood friend has this land, it's beautiful, and her mom loves movies, so she'd probably let you film there for a pretty low rate. And I was like, sweet, let's check it out. I checked out the land, I loved it, and I hadn't quite convinced her that I should be able to do it, but then I went to my producer's wedding. The owner of the house was there, and I'm like, oh, you're the owner of the house. And I sat there during this wedding, and I'm like, so you should let me shoot here, because this will pay you, and blah, 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 blah. And I managed to convince her there, and we got the place pretty cheap.
Nice. And the second house?
The second house, I think we just got through, my producer found it. I have no idea how she found it, because I kind of sent her off on that mission. You know, because my crew is so tiny that I'm so wrapped up in 900 other things, because I wrote, directed, shot, edited, you know, everything on the movie. So I'm doing a million camera tests and, you know, costume tests and robot tests and auditions. And I'm like, okay, producer, go find a house. And, you know, She did. So I think it was like a rental house, and she talked to the real estate agent and was like, hey, can we shoot here for a day? We only shot there for a day.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
So we knocked that out really fast.
And the liquor store.
The liquor store, my mom works for a nonprofit, and that nonprofit gets donations from that liquor store.
Hold on. A nonprofit gets liquor donations.
Yeah, well, because it's like an arts nonprofit, and I think they get liquor, like, for the events and stuff. I don't know. All I know is they're connected. And I was like, oh, I'm looking for some sort of store that they can go to. And I wanted a liquor store because there's so many liquor stores that aren't big chains. Because normally you can't shoot in anywhere that's a big chain because, you know, you have to talk to the higher-ups of the company. So I figured, okay, there's got to be a mom-and-pop liquor store around here somewhere. And sure enough, my mom was like, oh, yeah, we work with a liquor store all the time.
That's kind of funny. Okay, hold on. If you didn't have a liquor store, you have to take parts of your actual plot out.
I would have had to find something. Because I thought about that. I'm like, if I couldn't find a liquor store, because the character drinks a lot. You know, the character that takes the robot to the liquor store, he drinks a lot. And so I thought maybe like a restaurant with a bar in it. That was my next, like, option.
Well, JD even says one point during the film, says, thanks, Dad. And you kind of need that scene. And you've established that throughout the film.
Yeah. Yeah, the alcohol and the bottle breaking and all that, there's a through line of it. So, yeah, if I didn't find a liquor store, a bar probably would have been my next best bet.
And again, I think one of my favorite scenes of the film is that interaction in the liquor store between four people.
Oh, I love it. Isn't it great? Because in the liquor store, they run into – this isn't a spoiler. They run into another robot.
Okay, so I'm letting you spoil your own movie. I'm just hitting at things. You do what?
Please spoil me. But, yeah, so it's a home assistant robot. The family treats it poorly. The home assistant robot snaps and starts to demand proper treatment, right? And one of the pivotal scenes is in this liquor store, they go there and they see another robot, and she gets to see how other people treat their robots, and kind of she gets put on the spot to do kind of a party trick or whatever in front of this guy and his robot, and it's – well, you'll see in the movie what happens. But yeah, so it's one of my favorite scenes too. I love the actor who played the snooty robot owner. That's a lot of fun.
I'm going to ask a question. You can tell me if I'm wrong. So do we have – at the beginning of the film, we have a separate family we meet.
Yep.
Now, is that a prologue or an afterlogue?
That's a good question.
And I don't know if you're allowed to answer that.
No, I don't think it spoils it. And the thing is, it's kind of open-ended anyway.
Yes.
Because it could be either. But there is a detail that gives it away. And it's super small. I shot it to where it could be a prologue or an epilogue. No, you know what? I shot it to where it could be a prologue or an epilogue, but I think when I showed it to the studio, they asked the same question. Now there's that text. That was one of the last thing I did is when we start meeting that other family, it says 3 weeks earlier. So I think it's an epilogue that we show in the beginning. But that's initially, when I made it to be ambiguous. Yeah.
Okay, maybe I was making notes, and I do that sometimes, so I might have missed the 3 weeks earlier, which I will say.
It's pretty small, because I made it small on purpose, because I didn't really want that to be important.
Well, I think if somebody saw it on the big screen, they probably have a little more attention than I do. I mean, I'm watching on my computer, and I'm taking notes at the same time, so I do miss things occasionally.
Right.
Now, was the man coming over to visit the people in the first scene, the nosy neighbor?
Was the what? Sorry, say again?
There's a man that comes over to visit the family in the first scene.
Yeah.
Is he the nosy neighbor?
Neighbor, yeah. Yeah, because originally it was going to be a cop who had – the neighbors had called, and the cop was checking in and making sure everything was okay. And then we get there on set, and it's like, uh-oh, our cop can't show up because it was one of the few unpaid parts, right? Because I always pay my actors, but for parts like that where it's like a quarter of a day of shooting, I'll usually just call a friend up, you know, an actor friend. And that day the cop fell through, and so I'm like, crap, who do I got? And so I just called somebody to play a nosy neighbor because he didn't look like a cop. And so I'm like, you know, I couldn't imagine him putting him in a cop uniform and having him do that. So I just kind of had him be the nosy neighbor and peek in the windows and, you know, I heard screaming. Is everything okay? You know.
You also have a guy in the shower.
That's me.
Okay. How long did you have to stay in the shower for?
Oh, God. I don't know, because that shower takes forever. That shower was on the other side of the house, and so it took like 10 minutes for the water heater to get the hot water in there. So I'm waiting for this cold shower. It finally gets warm, and then all of a sudden it's really, really hot, and it fogs up. So we have to turn it off, wipe the fog off, and get it at just the right temperature to where it's not going to fog up. And then my assistant camera, because I shot the movie, and so that was the only shot of the movie I didn't shot, because I was going to have my cameo. And so, you know, I had my camera assistant just throw it on the dolly and get my my body in the shower.
Are you in all your films?
I am. I'm hiding somewhere in all of them. Some more obvious than others. But I'm in all my films very briefly, usually.
Oh, there we go. Then we get introduced to the robot's voice.
Yeah.
And I find it's very distinctive. Did you have – hold on, I did write her name down. Your robot actress do it Ray normally?
So what I did with her and her robot voice, that was easily the hardest part of the entire movie, was getting that voice right. Because it was making it understandable was actually the toughest part. You know, because now that the movie is on its way out, people are like, oh, the robot voice is, you know, generic or this or that. I'm like, I'm just glad you can understand it. That was my first and foremost goal with the robot. I wanted you to be able to understand it, and I didn't want to synthesize it. I wanted it to be something that you could understand, and I wanted Ray, the woman in the robot, you know, costume, I wanted you to be able to understand her. I wanted her performance to come through. I wanted it to be Ray's performance, and I wanted it to be on set. I didn't want it to be ADR. I wanted, you know, the real actors talking to each other. I wanted that dialogue from on set. So we record that dialogue, and then I tried a million different options. I ran through Melodyne to kind of get the auto-tune GLaDOS thing, but since the audio was on set and there's like air conditioners and crickets and stuff in the background, I couldn't get it clean enough to do the auto-tune thing to it. So I started looking at something called audio flangers. And what that does is sound is a wave. And what it does is it'll bend that wave, compress it, stretch it, whatever. And kind of got just the right amount of flang and metallicness to achieve that goal of it's her performance, it's her voice, but it sounds robotic. It's her performance as it was on set.
Now, people say the voice is generic, but this is a first generation kind of thing I'm getting at. They're still working out the bugs and stuff.
Yeah, you know, that's actually one of the deleted scenes. This movie has more deleted scenes than I've ever had. The movie is an hour and 26 or 27 minutes, and the original cut was an hour and like 46 minutes. So I cut out 20 minutes, and one of the scenes I cut out was them discussing, oh yeah, this is a first generation model, so it looks creepy, it sounds buggy, its behavior is unpredictable. And it was just one of those things that ultimately slowed the movie down. But yeah, it's supposed to be a first generation model.
Okay, that's the way I took it. So I would never worry about the robot's voice because I figured it was just a prototype.
Yeah, so exactly. That was my thinking as well.
Okay, JD brings it home. I want to discuss JD's wardrobe is really what I'm after.
Yeah.
The first shirt he wears, it has a slogan on it. Something I wish I wrote it down. Headgear and the air raids and the rails.
Oh, gosh. Hold on. Let's see if I can pull it up.
I apologize. I was trying to write it down. So I just want to know, who picked his wardrobe?
So it was me and him. And the reason I don't remember what was on the shirts was because he presented me options. They were all his shirts. I can't find it. So we wanted him to be a fan of metal music because the actor in real life, Brad Belemjian, is a huge metal music fan. I'm a metal music fan. He is a huge metal music fan, right? And I like older metal. He likes the new metalcore stuff, the screamo stuff, the sludge stuff, the, you know, the heavy duty stuff. And so he's a super metal fan. And what I wanted to do, we decided it's on set too. It was last second because I wanted him to look super casual, super laid back. I wanted that likable brother come off and that sort of nerdy thing to come off because he's the one that knows everything about the robot. And so he brought his metal band t-shirts and it's, you know, we establish in the movie that he's a fan of metal music, which becomes a plot point later. And so he's like, I brought a bunch of metal t-shirts. Do you want to have me wear them? And I was like, yes, but we should be really silly with it and make each shirt describe the scene that you're in. So at one point, when he's fighting the robot, it's a Rage Against the Machine t-shirt.
I knew it.
When he's dying at one point, you know, because he gets injured at one point, it's no surprise the robot's going to injure people. He gets injured at one point, and he's wearing an As I Lay Dying shirt at that point. When he's being mean to the robot, he has a shirt that says, all of our gods have abandoned us.
That's it. That's what I wanted to talk about.
Yeah. That one, I think it's a band called The Architects. I can't remember. Atheism is kind of like a metal music cliche. If you go into new screamo music, there's so much merch and so much music that's just like, there is no God. And
that's
so
it. Gods have abandoned us t-shirt. I got it written down. It is my notes.
Yeah, so when he showed me that shirt, I was like, this is perfect for the scene. And when you watch, it's that dramatic scene in the middle, you know, where, oh, I can say, well, I can't say.
No, you can't.
You know what I'm, yeah. I tie my stories together so tight. I tie all the plot points together so tightly. Everything is a domino effect. I love, my biggest pet peeve in movies is bad pacing, right? Like, especially in indie movies. Because I do trailers. I do a lot of movie trailers. my income. And so I have seen just dozens and dozens, as I'm sure you have as a critic, dozens and dozens of these indie movies. And I'm like, look, I can get past the bad effects. I can get past the low budget. What I can't get past is really, really bad acting and a bad script and bad pacing. Because look, man, I will even sit through shit acting if the movie's blistering fast. You know, I've seen movies that are funny or super gory and the acting is terrible, but it's like, well, at least I'm not bored. Boring is the number one Paramount movie sin, period. And so that is always my approach. And so when I write these scripts, I see these art movies in particular. I like a lot of the highbrow horror stuff, you know, like Hereditary, Midsommar, The Witch, whatever. I like that stuff. They have the high tier cast and the production value to really make it sing. But so often I'm like, okay, when are we going to get somewhere? When are we going to get somewhere? When are we going to get somewhere? Now, usually the filmmaking is good enough to sustain you, but in an indie movie, you got to keep moving, man. You don't have Robert Pattinson or some amazing actor, you know, Oscar caliber actor that you could just watch compulsively, you know? So I try and keep the movies moving, moving, moving. And every time by like halfway or two thirds of the way through the movie, I run out of story. And that's where things get interesting, because I'm like, now that everything has happened that you think can happen, what happens after that? You know, and so maybe somebody dies. Maybe I bring somebody back to life. Maybe I loop things back around. I like movies that kind of chase their own tail, you know.
And yours does that. I don't think you allow the viewer to have any idea the end of this film, which we're not going to even go near. But I don't think I had my own idea. And you went there, and then you totally threw it back at me at the end.
I love it. I love doing that so much. The thing that really impacted me was seeing Poltergeist as a teenager. And there's that scene where they've gotten the ghost out of the house, they've got the girl, Carol Ann or whatever, back, and they're all moving, and they're packing up, and it's a typical Spielberg ending, and you're like, ah, the movie's over. And then it's not over. And you're like, and the starts throwing shit around again, and you're like, what the fuck is that? This is the second climax out of nowhere. And it's my favorite thing in the whole world when a movie throws you for a loop, you know. It really stuck with me. Same with, like, Alien. In the middle of Alien, when, oh, yeah, this guy's a robot. I'm like, what? Where did that come? But it makes perfect sense, you know.
It did.
So that's what I'm always trying to pull.
Now I can read my scribble. Now I take attention. I want to discuss the headdress. Turn my volume so you don't keep picking up me on your Skype. I think on your robot, is it a straight mask or is it CG'd at the back or what's going on there?
Both.
Okay, so it is CG'd at the back. The colors look CG'd to me.
Oh, no, the back is real.
The back is all real.
Back's all real. Isn't that cool?
That is very cool. Well, how did you design that? Let's start there then.
I actually didn't design it. So my friend, who's an amazing filmmaker, Charlie Steeds, he did a movie called Escape from Cannibal Farm. He did another great movie called Winter Skin. He's got this movie coming out called The Barge People. Great filmmaker. So we talk a lot. And originally, it was going to be this cartoony giant robot suit for like $5,000, right? And I'm like, man, that really ups the budget. And the higher budget you go, the more the financiers and the studio want control. And I wanted this movie to be what I wanted it to be. I had an idea of where it would go. I wanted it to be violent. I wanted it to be scary. I wanted it to be thrilling. But they're like, no, we need something really straightforward. You can't really play too many games, whatever. And so I said, if I can find a way to bring the budget down, right, can we, you know, can I do it my way? And they're like, totally, you know. And so I brought the budget down by quite a bit by doing that. But what Charlie had shown me is, like, there's this company that makes these masks. They're silicone masks, handmade to order. They're like $800. And then what you can do is have them custom paint pieces up, you know, things like that. And so that's exactly what we did. We got the mask. But then the mask is so scary, and it looks so creepy, and it was a female mask. Originally, it was a male cartoony robot. So it went from a male cartoony robot to a slender female robot, and that totally changed the tone of the story. So I started going through the script trying to fit that in, only to realize it kind of rippled and changed everything. So then I looked at my two scripts. I'm like, okay, which of these do I want to do? But it was no question. It was the more sinister, kind of cold, distant female robot rather than the giddy, happy-go-lucky, slowly becoming heartbroken, cartoony little boy robot, right? And so we bought this mask, and then what we did was we got these contacts, and they look like circuit boards. So those were the irises. The irises look like circuit boards. We put those in. We put black makeup around her eye, but that's going to smudge. That's going to look like makeup. So digitally, I went in frame by frame or keyframe by keyframe. That took me the longest, the voice and the eyes. I blacked out those circles around the eyes in the computer to make it look kind of uncanny, to kind of assist the mask in already, you know, which already looks uncanny. But the back actually had LED wire, which kept giving us issues. And then it shorts out in the middle of the movie, and I got it on camera. So then I just ripped it out. I'm done with this LED wire. But the dome on the back, it's this rubber dome, and underneath it is a remote-controlled LED light. And we would change the light based on her mood. And so there are little shots where she'll be talking, and it's green or blue, blah, blah, blah. And then something will happen that scares her. It'll turn yellow, or it'll turn red, or she, you know.
Damn, I totally missed that.
Yeah. I know, it's super subtle, and you can only see it in a couple of shots. But yeah, the light on the back of her head indicates her mood. Red would be angry, sad would be blue, happy is green, and then yellow is scared. But I think all the yellow scenes got cut out. But yeah, it always reflects her emotion.
Wow. Okay. So was Ray okay putting the mask on, and was she comfortable, or how would that feel? Was it hot outside? Cool outside? It must have been a lot of work.
It was high 90s. Outside Fahrenheit. So it was just miserable and awful. And that scene in the barn where I can say Alpha gets a gun pulled on her, because that, if you know, that would make me want to watch the movie if I hear, oh, this robot gets a gun pulled on her. She gets a gun pulled on her in this barn, and that barn was, I mean, it had to have been over 100 degrees in there. And so between takes, she's taking off this mask, but the mask is so dense, because that's it conforms to your skin, right? It sticks to your skin, so you can see the muscles move above your eyebrows or below your eyes, and your lips will move with the mask. And so in between takes, she's taking it off, she's sweating off all the makeup, whatever. But she is a certified stunt double. She is Kate Blanchett, Nicole Kidman, Christina Hendricks, a body double. In The Strangers Pray at Night, most close-up shots of hands and backs, that's Ray. So she does stunts. She does body double work. She did a sex scene in Nicole Kidman's place for Killing of a Sacred Deer. So she's used to that kind of stuff. She's used to being put on the line, not even because it's dangerous, but because it's uncomfortable. So when it's like, hey, Ray, you have to wear a spandex suit and Japanese nurse shoes. That's what those shoes were. They were Japanese.
Oh, okay.
I got them from, like, Japanese Amazon. I paid for them in yen. It was weird. But – and then, yeah, so she's a trooper, but never once complained. And it didn't take her long to get suited up either. So, but yeah, she did everything herself without a peep of complaint. She was my nun in my movie Curse of the Nun. So I had worked with her before in that capacity as a monster. And I'm working with her again in 2 weeks on a French short film. She's great.
There you go. How many beer bottles did you break?
We had a box of 16 And they were like easy break bottles. So yes. They were made to shatter so we could hit them on people's head and all that stuff. And there's a story where somebody got hit in the head with one. It was in the head or in the face. I can't remember, but they're like, I want to see how it feels. So we smack them in the head with the bottle and they're like, oh, it hurts. It hurts. It hurts. And it doesn't hurt. I tested it on myself about a million times. I think that's what I did with the first five bottles. I smashed it right on my face. And so then all the other actors are like, I don't want to smash one on my head. And I'm like, you can smash one on my head first. So that's what they did. A couple of them. Pew, right across the face. That's how we ended the production, too. That was that's a wrap. We took the final beer bottle. I gave it to the lead. And I was like, all right, smash it on my head.
Okay. The caring of Alpha. Did you go into it a bit? Was there more depth coming for that, or you cut it?
The what of Alpha?
Caring her, like, just the general understanding of Alpha. Like, you do walk me through it, but I thought there'd be a little bit more technique stuff with JD.
Oh, like technique in the acting.
Yes.
Yeah, no, there was a lot of technique in the acting on her part, and that's something we sat down and we discussed. What she does is she slowly becomes more human through the movie. That was the first and foremost objective, was that she starts out, you know, robotic movement, robotic voice, yes. Like even in its cadence, like she would talk like this and put emphasis on words like that, while at the end, the more emotional she becomes, the more she's kind of just spitting this, you know, emotional human dialect. The processing actual filter on it stays the same, but the cadence, that's why I wanted her performance to come through. I wanted it to sound more human. I wanted it to sound more emotional. So at the beginning, more robotic. At the end, more human. The movement, same thing. You know, there were certain kind of, you know, we limited the movement in her legs to kind of look stiff, because if you look at those Boston Dynamics robots, they don't walk like humans, or they walk too perfectly. You know what I mean? So there's a lot of that. It's like, make each footstep count, make each knee bend count, or stiffen your knees for certain things. I think the way I described it to her was, make every movement deliberate and know where that movement is going to end. Exactly where it's going to end, because that's how a computer thinks. If I put my arm forward, I don't know where it's going to end. So it's just kind of like there. But like, it's like, okay, imagine that's where it's going to end. That's where it's going to end, you know. So that was a big thing with it as well. Yeah, those were probably the big things that we discussed. And then from there, I kind of let Ray do her thing. She was so in the zone and giving me great stuff. She'd probably have a better answer to that question than I would, you know, but I trusted her. And once we had talked about that stuff, I kind of just let her go and do her thing.
Were you giving a shout out to Evil Inferno, the film? Is that somebody's friend film of yours, or just something you made up?
So there's a point in the movie where they're watching TV. They watch TV a lot in the movie because I wanted the robot to learn from the TV. And they watch this movie called Evil Inferno. And I came up with Evil Inferno by trying to come up with the dumbest, most generic action movie name I could come up with. That's all it was. And I think I was thinking of I was actually thinking of Volcano. That movie Volcano. And so I was like, okay, like Evil Inferno, but then there's Towering Inferno. And that didn't come until later, but yeah, Evil Inferno. I just tried to come up with something silly and generic, but not something too silly where it would get a laugh before I wanted a laugh, because you see the movie itself, and the movie itself is hilarious and gory and silly. And that's what I wanted to be the joke. So that's just a generic action movie name.
The posters in JD's bedroom, who chose them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I see Jaws 2. I know it's Jaws or Jaws 2. I can't quite remember. Jaws. And I know there's a couple other ones, but you pan by them so quick, I would have to rewind them and pause them to get them.
Yeah, so there's a Slipknot poster, because he loves metal music, and we love Slipknot. There's that Godzilla poster from my office, because I love it. And I thought, okay, he's a horror movie guy. He's a monster movie guy, you know. Plus, I mean, I love monster movies. I love Jaws. I love Godzilla. And so kind of winking at those movies. And then there's a poster for Clowntergeist and Curse of the Nun, which are the first two movies that I made.
I knew it. I thought they were yours. Like, I didn't recognize two of them quickly.
Yeah. So those were the ones that I made. So I figured, oh, he put them there too. And then on the bed at one point, he's so quick, nobody ever sees it. But there's a really high up shot when JD's doing repairs on the robot at one point. There's a really high up shot, and there's a bunch of stuff on the bed.
Yes.
And there's a Nightmare on Elm Street collection on the bed, and the movie we put out was Dream Warriors because we thought he might watch. I can't remember if it was Dream Warriors. It was the one with all the gay undertones. I can't remember which one it was.
Dreamweaver.
It might have been. I remember looking it up because it's been so long since I'd seen them all. But we put the one with the gay undertones on the bed just because, I don't know, why not?
How am I supposed to see that? You put so much exposition in that scene.
I know.
Like, I really have to listen to the scene and make notes. It's hard to watch it.
Well, that's what's so great. I love it. It just glosses right in front of people, and it's great, you know. And usually it's one of those things, too, where it's like, in the moment, you get the camera up there, because for that particular shot, we get the camera up there in the corner of the room, and we're like, crap, you know, the frame is nice, but the bed is really empty. So we had designed the room on the first day of shooting. You know, on the first day of shooting in that house, we didn't do much, but we designed the bedroom, and we designed, you know, just certain areas of the house that needed it. And so we just took everything off the bedside table, tossed it on the bed, and like, okay, that goes there, and then all of a sudden it's immortalized in the movie.
Because you pan to the Jaws poster and go straight down. And literally that's how you shoot that shot. Unless you edited it, did two shots and edited them together on day.
I can't remember. Because I remember the Jaws poster, we kept moving.
Oh, okay. So that's why. Okay. Because I'm like, okay, it wasn't just me that poster moved. I thought it was my brain.
Yeah, definitely moved. Because there was a scene where it was there. Because the wall was blank.
Yes.
And there's like a scene 30 minutes later. And I'm like, crap. That wall is blank and the poster's too small to show up on camera. And I was like, well, just switch them. And they're like, well, aren't they going to notice that? I'm like, some people will notice it.
I did notice.
What would notice more is an ugly white wall just sitting there. So just move the Jaws poster.
Okay, now we have to go to my favorite character in the film. She's only in her minor, and I'm sure you know who I'm going to talk about.
My favorite character in the film, too. I already know who you're going to say.
Like, Happy House Cleaners, Mimi shirt.
Mimi the maid.
How is Mimi a happy housekeeper? As the guy quotes, Mimi's a bitch. And she totally is.
So that's Alice Raver. And I've worked with her a couple of times now. But she's the nicest person who plays the best bitch. It's like this inverse thing where she could just tap into this energy. I don't know what it is. But she was my first and only choice for that character, and I'm like, you're going to play a bitchy maid, and you're going to work for – the Happy Homes Cleaner thing was a coincidence. Not a coincidence, but a happy, fortuitous moment, because my producer had a cleaning business before she started really producing, and it was Happy Homes Cleaners.
Oh,
and
God. I'm like, okay,
we got to make her some kind of shirt with a business on it. And she's like, well, you can use one of my old Happy Homes Cleaner shirt. I'm like, that's perfect. So when we see her pull up, she's blasting trashy country music in her beat-up car. She gets out. She's got the Happy Homes Cleaner T-shirt on. And she's just a major – where I got the idea, me and Brad Valemchian, who plays JD, he helped me come up with a lot of the ideas in the beginning phases. And we had seen Lars von Trier's The House That Jack Built together. We had driven like 3 hours. I loved that movie. God, I loved it. It was insane. Insane. Just heartbreaking and mesmerizing. But what really struck us was – Uma Thurman at the beginning of the movie is so obnoxious, and you know that Matt Dillon's character is a serial killer, and you know she keeps joking, oh, I bet you're some kind of serial killer out here all alone, and you're thinking, uh-oh, yeah, he is. And then she's like, can you help me fix my tire? Here's a tire iron. Here's a car jack. And you're like, at any moment, he's going to hit her in the face with one of these. And it's such a bizarre way to establish the character, because you're supposed to detest this character throughout most of the movie. But it's like, if you detest him through the whole movie, you're not going to be engaged, especially if it's 3 hours. So what they do is they give you the scene at the beginning where you're like, okay, you know what? Kill Uma Thurman's character. She's obnoxious. Just kill her and I won't hate you for it. So when he kills her, you don't hate her for it. And so I don't mind spoiling that. Mimi is terrible to the robot. So when the robot starts getting angry, right, she goes for Mimi first. And that way my idea was like, okay, so the audience won't hate her when she confronts Mimi. So that was the thinking.
So part two to my question, since you've kind of said, you drop trash bags in the water.
Mm-hmm.
What's in my trash bags?
So I had just finished a movie called Death Ranch. I produced a movie called Death Ranch for Charlie Seath, the filmmaker I was talking about earlier. He's a British filmmaker, wanted to do a film in America, so I had him come out here. We shot in some beautiful land in Tennessee. But one of the things that we needed was a mannequin. Because there's a scene where somebody gets hung and they're in a full costume and a mask and a helmet, whatever. So it's like, oh, just get a mannequin, put the mannequin in the costume, hang the costume, or hang the mannequin. And then when he left, he's like, I can't take this mannequin with me back to the UK, so you want to keep it? I'm like, what am I going to do with a mannequin? And I just stuffed it in, I took it apart, I stuffed it in the trash bags with a bunch of bloody paper towels, like paper towels soaked in fake blood. And so that way, it's like, guts, 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 is that a hand? Guts, 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 are those abs? Guts, 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 you know, so that's what that was.
I had to ask.
Yeah, I'm glad you did. It's a good question.
No, I just thought it was interesting. I've always wanted to know. Okay, we're going to only have about 20 minutes left, and I know you're going to fill it no problem, so I'm going to jump to a few things I want to discuss.
Sure.
You have a long shot in the barn of Alpha closing the door.
Mm-hmm.
Beautiful.
Thank you.
I want to say, did you know that shot ahead of time, or the lighting was perfect on it, or just that appealed to you?
No, you know, what happened was I'm assuming you're talking about the shot at nighttime when she picks up the crowbar?
Yes, that's exactly where I am.
How that came about was, it was nighttime, and nighttime, you never know exactly how you're going to light nighttime because you don't know what you have on hand. Because sometimes I'll be shooting a night scene, I'll get on set, it's completely pitch black. But then I'll get to set, I'll be like, okay, well, there's this street lamp over here that I didn't anticipate. So I'll make the lighting around this street lamp, I'll emulate the street light, right? And I knew story-wise that there was a car there, and I knew that I have the barn there. So I thought, okay, she's either going to open the doors and turn the lights on, or maybe one light, and a light would shine on that crowbar. But then I thought, okay, you can't see her, and then she would emerge. But I'm like, I don't really know. And then we had a car, and I was like, let's see what the headlights look like behind her, like where we backlight the scene and let the silhouette dominate the shot. And that ended up being the choice. We parked a car there, blasted the headlights, and it was really cool because the doors slide open, and so you can see the light through the cracks. So the doors roll, and it's like, you know, you can see the light kind of rippling as she opens the door. So that was the thinking there, was to let the backlight and the silhouette dominate it, because it makes her scarier. It's one of the first movies where it's like, okay, she means business, and so that emoted that better.
It's my favorite shot in the film. I'll tell you.
Right on. I love that shot. I mean, it's probably the most stylish shot in the movie.
It is.
The movie I did after that, Ouija Craft, it's like all style. I do the giallo lighting, like the crazy colors. I went nuts. But for this one, I had never shot my own movie. I'd shot my own movie before. I'd shot short films. I had shot my previous movie out of necessity. But this was the first one where I had intended to shoot it. So I'm like, okay, I'm going to keep it pretty sci-fi, pretty clean, and pretty suburban, because it's suburban. I want it to feel homely. So, yeah, the style was pretty pared down. So shots like that were fun.
How was the underwater shooting?
Underwater shooting was so much fun. There's a picture of me on Instagram in the pool not wanting to get out, because it was so – there was a pool at the house that we were shooting at, which was just – having a pool on set, because during lunch every day, we shot for 15 days, and every day except for the days it was raining, we'd go out, we'd swim in the pool, and I knew we'd have a pool scene. That was one of the few things I needed from the start. I'm like, we need a pool, because the robot is waterproof. So if you have a waterproof robot, if a robot is coming for you, where do you go? The pool. That would be a great place to hide from a waterproof robot. So I knew that from the start. And what it was is, it's this little bag called a Dyka Pack. And it's like a Ziploc bag that you fold over a million times, then Velcro at the top. And my camera barely fit in there. It's like $50. I squeezed it in there, and then I went under the water of the pool, even for shots that are underwater of the pond, because there's some underwater stuff in the pond. I just color graded it to make it look murky. And we shot it at night and shined one single crazy light in there to make it look like it was murky, not night. And the sun was the thing that was peeking through. But to keep me at the bottom of the pool ended up being the trickiest part. I'd get down to the bottom of the pool, just swimming, me, and I'd have the camera right here. It's got a little plastic thing where I can see what I'm shooting. And I keep floating up because I'm holding my breath, because I love swimming. I swim in my free time. There was a year where I swam every day. So I had no problem holding my breath for, you know, a minute and a half. But I kept flowing to the top. And so my boom operator, who's like 6'1", went into the deeper end of the pool, stepped on my shoulders, and that's how he was able to hold me down, and that's how we were able to shoot up underwater.
You may kill me, but I'm going to ask my last question before we get to fun questions.
Yeah, go for it.
Will there be a sequel?
I hope so, man. That'd be so much fun.
I hope I'm not ruining anything. I tried to keep that very...
No, because, well, I mean, I can say, when you make movies at this level, especially when they're funded by somebody, because I've done things that are funded by me, and I've done things that are funded by people. And when a thing is funded by people, what they say is, make it to where it is open-ended enough for a sequel, but closed-ended enough to be satisfying on its own, right? And so the end implies something, and I'm happy to end it there. But if they came to me tomorrow and they said, hey, we want another Alpha movie, it did really well, I'd be like, amazing. Because everybody loved working on it. It was so much fun. And it was so easy. It was the easiest movie I've ever shot. That's what blew my mind. Like, my other movies have been so physical and so gory and so tough. And this one, man, we were swimming in the pool every day. We were in the air-conditioned house. Like, yeah, it has its typical bumps, and it was typically, you know, production is exhausting. But this one was so much fun. And so if they were like, we need another one, I'm like, yeah, hell yeah, man, let's do it. You know, a little more money to do some more, you know, flashy effects and flashy kills. I'd be all for it.
I do want to go over the cast. Wonderfully cast. I thought the family was real.
Thank you.
I thought they all worked off together. I really believed Louis' story. I really believed JD's story. I thought the parents' interaction worked.
Yeah.
Good job.
Thank you. I'm so glad. That's one, you know, what I work hard on, because it's, like I said, second to being boring and bad writing, it's bad acting. If you have good acting that isn't boring with good writing, you're in the clear, man.
Okay, I did have more questions, but we only have 14 minutes left, and you'll probably fill 14 minutes with my three questions, so that's fine. I just want to make sure it fits, and I don't have to edit it, so that's why.
Yeah, no worries.
Because you've never been on the show before, your favorite film?
My favorite film is Heathers, 1989, Winona Ryder.
Absolutely fabulous.
I have a million favorite films. I've seen The Big Lebowski 150,000 times. I've seen Jaws 150 million times. I think I've seen Jaws more than I've seen any other movie, actually. Because when I was learning filmmaking, I took it into Premiere and went cut by cut to see how they edited it, because I cut my own stuff. So Jaws, I love Scream. Scream. I love the fusion of horror and comedy. This movie, Alpha, doesn't have as much comedy as I usually have. I usually have a nice comedic undertone or comedic current. There's funny stuff in Alpha, but I usually, like, Curse of the Nun has like a full-on comedic relief character. But I got to give that trophy to Heathers. No movie comforts me more than it just popping that one in. I can quote the whole damn thing.
Favorite film starring a robot?
Favorite film starring a robot. God damn, that's a good one.
I figured you must have one.
Oh, I've got a lot. That's why I'm sitting here thinking, we've got giant robots, we've got humanoid, we've got like Ex Machina is the first thing that comes to mind. But that one's like dramatic and like real robot. That's a realistic robot. So realistic robot, yeah, man, that takes the prize. But then you go back to like Forbidden Planet or The Day the Earth Stood Still, you know, and those two robots, they're great. And then, though, if I had to give a favorite movie robot, she's not really a robot, but she is. She's artificial intelligence. And that is the robot from Her, the voice that Joaquin Phoenix talks to, Samantha.
I would argue she's a robot. Artificial intelligence is a robot. I'd give it to you.
But, and then also a big shout out to the kaijus in Pacific Rim. Those things are dope. And the Bicentennial Man. I watched that one too when studying for Alpha, but I love the Bicentennial Man.
Okay. One film you've never seen and should have.
Too many. I watch so much random shit. Everyone's like, why did you just watch a random Australian movie about a killer boar? And you haven't seen XYZ? I'm like, I don't know. I just felt like it. That I haven't seen that I should have. Probably The Godfather Part 2.
Ooh. That's a big one.
That's a big one, yeah. I've seen The Godfather Part 1, but I have not seen Part 2.
Okay. So
yeah, that's probably the biggest one.
Oh, fair enough. Before you go, tell everybody where they can find your film. I know it's not going to be out for 2 weeks, so if you're listening to this tomorrow or in a week, you still got to wait a week.
Yeah, You got to wait 2 weeks, but it's coming. You can check out the trailer. Just Google it, the Alpha Test trailer. It'll come up. The movie will be available on Amazon, like Amazon Rentals, Vudu. Sometimes it's available on your Xbox, on their movie site. It's usually available on demand on your cable box. Amazon is always like the go-to place to get it. And then it's going to be on DVD as well, which anywhere you get DVDs online, you'll be able to find it. And then anywhere else you rent movies digitally. YouTube is usually another good place to rent it, the YouTube rental, movie rental, Google Play. That's where it'll be. It'll just be everywhere, everywhere you can get movies digitally.
Well, thanks for your time. I hope you had a good time, because I know I did.
Hi, man. This was so much fun. I'm so happy to be here.
So you have a great night, and I hope to see you again soon.
Yeah, man. You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye.